The plague never ceased. All through these days I was waiting and listening, watching, when I could, everyone who went out of the palace or came in. It was well for me that the king found plenty of work, both for the fox and me, in the pillar room. Messengers and letters from the neighbouring kings were coming in every day, demanding impossible things and contrary things, dragging up old quarrels or claiming old promises. They knew how things were in Gloam, and they clustered round us like flies and crows round a dying sheep. My father would pass in and out of his rages a dozen times in one morning. When he was in them, he would slap the fox about the face and pull me by the ears or the hair. And then between the fits the tears would stand in his eyes, and he would speak to us more like a child imploring help than a king asking counsel. "Trapped!" he would say. "No way out. They will kill me by inches. What have I done that all these miseries should fall upon me? I've been a God-fearing man all my life." The only betterment in these days was that the fever seemed to have left the palace. We'd lost a good many slaves, but we had better luck with the soldiers. Only one died, and all the rest were now back at duty. Then we heard that the priest of Ungit had recovered from his fever. His sickness had been very long, for he had taken the fever and won over it and then taken it again, so that it was a wonder he should be alive. But it was noticed for a strange and unlucky thing about this sickness, that it killed the young more easily than the old. On the seventh day after this news, the priest came to the palace. The king, who saw his coming, as I did too, from the windows of the pillar room, said, "What does the old carrion mean by coming here with half an army?" There were indeed a good many spears behind his litter, for the house of Ungit has its own guards, and he had brought a big handful with him. They grounded their spears some distance from our gates, and only the litter was carried to the porch. "They'd better come no nearer," said the king. "Is this treason, or only pride?" Then he gave some order to the captain of his own guard. I don't think he expected it would come to a fight, but that was what I, being still young, looked for. I had never seen men fight, and being as big a fool in that way as most girls, I felt no dread, rather a little tingling that I liked well enough. The bearers set down the litter, and the priest was lifted out of it. He was very old now and blind, and he had two temple girls with him to lead him. I had seen their kind before, but only by torchlight in the house of Ungit. They looked strange under the sun, with their gilt paps and their huge flaxen wigs, and their faces painted till they looked like wooden masks. Only these two and the priest, with one hand on the shoulder of each, came into the palace. As soon as they were in, my father called out to our men to shut and bar the door. "The old wolf would hardly walk into such a trap if he meant mischief," he said, "but we'll make sure." The temple girls led the priest into the pillar room, and a chair was set for him, and he was helped into it. He was out of breath and sat for a long time before he spoke, making a chewing motion with his gums, as old men do. The girls stood stiffly at each side of his chair, their meaningless eyes looking always straight ahead out of the mask of their painting. The smell of old age, and the smell of the oils and essences they put on those girls, and the Ungit smell filled the room. It became very holy. Chapter 5. My father greeted the priest and wished him joy of his recovery, and called for wine to be given him. But the priest held up his hand and said, "No, king, I am under a strong vow, and neither food nor drink must pass my lips till I have given my message." He spoke well enough now, though weakly, and I noticed how much thinner he was since his sickness. "As you please, servant of Ungit," said the king. "What's this of a message?"
"I am speaking to you, king, with the voice of Ungit and the voice of all the people and elders and nobles of Gloam."
"Did all these, then, send you with a message?"
"Yes. We were all gathered, or those who could speak, for all were gathered, last night and even till this day's daybreak, in the house of Ungit."
"Were you, death and scabs?" said my father, frowning. "It's a new fashion to hold an assembly without the king's bidding, and newer still to hold it without bidding the king to it."
There would have been no reason in bidding you to it, King, seeing that we came together not to hear what you would say to us, but to determine what we would say to you.
My father's look grew very black.
And being gathered together, said the priest, we reckoned up all the woes that have come upon us. First, the famine, which still increases. Second, the pestilence. Third, the drought. Fourth, the certain expectation of war by next spring at the latest. Fifth, the lions. And lastly, King, your own barrenness of sons, which is hateful to Ungit.
That's enough, shouted the king. You old fool, do you think I need you or any of the other wiseacres to tell me where my own belly aches? Hateful to Ungit, is it? Why does Ungit not mend it, then? She's had bulls and rams and goats from me in plenty, blood enough to sail a ship on if all were reckoned.
The priest jerked up his head as if, though blind, he were looking at the king. And now I saw better how his thinness had changed him. He looked like a vulture. I was more afraid of him than I had been. The king dropped his eyes.
"Bulls and rams and goats will not win Ungit's favour while the land is impure," said the priest. "I have served Ungit these 63 years, and I've learned one thing for certain. Her anger never comes upon us without cause, and it never ceases without expiation. I have made offerings to her for your father and your father's father, and it has always been the same. We were overthrown long before your day by the king of Assur, and that was because there was a man in your grandfather's army who had lain with his sister and killed the child. He was the accursed. We found him out and expiated his sin, and then the men of Glom chased the men of Assur like sheep. Your father himself could have told you how one woman, little more than a child, cursed Ungit's son, the god of the mountain, in secret. For her sake the floods came. She was the accursed. We found her out and expiated her sin, and Shenit returned into her banks. And now, by all the signs I have reckoned over to you, we know that Ungit's anger is far greater than ever within my memory. Thus we all said in her house last night, we all said, we must find the accursed. Though every man knew that he himself might be the accursed, no man spoke against it. I, too, I had not a word to say against it, though I knew that the accursed might be I, or you, King. For we all knew, and you may hold it for certain, that there will be no mending of all our ills till the land is purged. Ungit will be avenged. It's not a bull or a ram that will quiet her now.
"You mean she wants man?" said the king.
"Yes," said the priest. "Or woman."
"If they think I can get them a captive in war at present, they must be mad. The next time I take a thief, you can cut his throat over Ungit, if you like."
"That is not enough, King, and you know it. We must find the accursed, and she or he must die by the rite of the great offering. What is a thief more than a bull or a ram? This is not to be a common sacrifice. We must make the great offering. The brute has been seen again, and when it comes, the great offering must be made. That is how the accursed must be offered."
"The brute? It's the first I've heard of it."
"It may be so. Kings seem to hear very little. They do not know even what goes on in their own palaces. But I hear. I lie awake in the nights, very long awake, and Ungit tells me things. I hear of terrible doings in this land, mortals aping the gods and stealing the worship due to the gods."
I looked at the fox, and said soundlessly by the shaping of my lips, "Redivol." The king was walking up and down the room with his hands clasped behind his back and his fingers working. "You're doting," he said. "The brute's a tale of my grandmother's."
"It may well be," said the priest, "for it was in her time that the brute was last seen. And we made the great offering, and it went away."
"Who has ever seen this brute?" asked my father. "What is it like, eh?"
"Those who have seen it closest can least say what it is like, King, and many have seen it of late. Your own chief shepherd on the Grey Mountain saw it the night the first lion came.
He fell upon the lion with a burning torch, and in the light of the torch he saw the brute behind the lion, very black and big, a terrible shape. As the priest said this, the king's walk had brought him close to the table where I and the fox sat with our tablets and other tools for writing. The fox slid along the bench and whispered something in my father's ear.
"Well said, fox," muttered my father. "Speak up. Say it to the priest."
"By the king's permission," said the fox, "the shepherd's tale is very questionable. If the man had a torch, of necessity the lion would have a big black shadow behind it. The man was scared and new waked from sleep. He took a shadow for a monster."
"That is the wisdom of the Greeks," said the priest. "But Glom does not take counsel with slaves, not even if they are king's favourites. And if the brute was a shadow king, what then? Many say it is a shadow. But if that shadow begins coming down into the city, look to yourself. You are of divine blood and doubtless fear nothing, but the people will fear. Their fear will be so great that not even I will be able to hold them. They will burn your palace about your ears. They will bar you in before they burn it. You would be wiser to make the great offering." "How is it made?" said the king. "It has never happened in my time."
"It is not done in the house of Ungit," said the priest. "The victim must be given to the brute, for the brute is, in a mystery, Ungit herself or Ungit's son, the god of the mountain, or both. The victim is led up the mountain to the holy tree and bound to the tree and left. Then the brute comes. That is why you angered Ungit just now, king, when you spoke of offering a thief. In the great offering the victim must be perfect. For in holy language a man so offered is said to be Ungit's husband, and a woman is said to be the bride of Ungit's son, and both are called the brute's supper. And when the brute is Ungit it lies with the man, and when it is her son it lies with the woman, and either way there is a devouring. Many different things are said. Many sacred stories, many great mysteries. Some say the loving and the devouring are all the same thing, for in sacred language we say that a woman who lies with a man devours the man. That is why you are so wide of the mark, king, when you think a thief or an old worn-out slave or a coward taken in battle would do for the great offering. The best in the land is not too good for this office."
The king's forehead, I saw, was clammy now. The holiness and horror of divine things were continually thickening in that room. All at once the fox burst out.
"Master, master, let me speak!"
"Speak on," said the king.
"Do you not see, master," said the fox, "that the priest is talking nonsense? A shadow is to be an animal, which is also a goddess, which is also a god, and loving is to be eating. A child of six would talk more sense. And a moment ago the victim of this abominable sacrifice was to be the accursed, the wickedest person in the whole land offered as a punishment, and now it is to be the best person in the whole land, the perfect victim, married to the god as a reward. Ask him which he means. It can't be both."
If any hope had put up its head within me when the fox began, it was killed. This sort of talk could do no good. I knew what had happened to the fox. He had forgotten all his wiles, even in a way his love and fears for Psyche, simply because things such as the priest had been saying put him beyond all patience. I have noticed that all men, not only Greek men, if they have clear wits and ready tongues, will do the same.
"We are hearing much Greek wisdom this morning, king," said the priest, "and I have heard most of it before. I did not need a slave to teach it to me. It is very subtle, but it brings no rain and grows no corn. Sacrifice does both. It does not even give them boldness to die. That Greek there is your slave, because in some battle he threw down his arms and let them bind his hands and lead him away and sell him rather than take a spear thrust in his heart. Much less does it give them understanding of holy things. They demand to see such things clearly, as if the gods were no more than letters written in a book. I, king, have dealt with the gods for 3 generations of men, and I know that they dazzle our eyes and flow in and out of one another like eddies on a river, and nothing that is said clearly can be said truly about them. Holy places are dark places. It is life and strength, not knowledge and words, that we get in them. Holy wisdom is not clear and thin like water, but thick and dark like blood. Why should the accursed not be both the best and the worst?
The priest looked more and more like a gaunt bird as he was speaking, not unlike the bird mask that lay on his knees. And his voice, though not loud, was no longer shaking like an old man's. The fox sat hunched together with his eyes fixed on the table. The taunt about being taken in war, I guessed, had been hot iron to some old ulcer in his soul. Certainly I would that moment have hanged the priest and made the fox a king if power had been given me, but it was easy to see on which side the strength lay.
"Well, well," said the king, quickening his stride. "This may be all very true. I'm neither priest nor Greekling, I. They used to tell me I was the king. What's next?"
"Being determined, therefore," said the priest, "to seek out the accursed, we cast the holy lots. First we asked whether the accursed was to be found among the commons, and the lot said no."
"Go on, go on," said the king.
"I cannot speak quickly," said the priest. "I have not breath for it now. Then we asked if it was among the elders, and the lot said no."
There was a queer mottled colour on the king's face now. His fear and his anger were just on the balance, and neither he nor anyone else knew at all which would have the victory.
"Then we asked if it were among the nobles, and the lots said no."
"And then you asked?" says the king, stepping up close to him and speaking low.
And the priest said, "Then we asked, is it in the king's house?" And the lots said, "Yes."
"Aye," said the king, rather breathless. "Aye, I thought as much. I smelled it from the beginning. Treason in a new cloak. Treason." Then louder, "Treason!"
Next moment he was at the door, roaring,
"Treason! Treason! Guards! Bardia! Where are my guards? Where's Bardia? Send Bardia!"
There was a rush and a jingle of iron, and guards came running. Bardia, their captain, a very honest man, came in.
"Bardia," said the king, "there are too many people about my door today. Take what men you think you need and fall on those rebels who are standing with spears out yonder over against the gate. Don't scatter them, but kill. Kill, do you see? Don't leave one of them alive."
"Kill the temple guards, king?" said Bardia, looking from the king to the priest and back at the king again.
"Temple rats! Temple pimps!" shouted the king. "Are you deaf? Are you afraid? I—"
And his rage choked him.
"This is foolishness, king," said the priest. "All Gloam is in arms. There is a party of armed men at every door of the palace by now. Your guards are outnumbered 10 to 1, and they won't fight. Would you fight against Ungit, Bardia?"
"Will you slink away from my side, Bardia?" said the king. "After eating my bread, you were glad of my shield to cover you one day at Varin's Wood."
"You saved my head that day, king," said Bardia. "I'll never say otherwise. May Ungit send me to do as much for you. There may be chance enough next spring. I'm for the king of Gloam and the gods of Gloam while I live. But if the king and the gods fall out, you great ones must settle between you. I'll not fight against powers and spirits."
You girl!"
squealed the king, his voice shrill as a pipe.
"Then be off. I'll talk with you presently."
Bardia saluted and went out. You could see from his face that he cared no more for the insult than a great dog cares for a puppy making believe to fight him. The moment the door was shut, the king, all quiet and white again, whipped out his dagger, the same he killed the page with the night Psyche was born, stepped up to the priest's chair in 3 long cat's strides, shouldered the 2 girls away, and had the point of the dagger through the priest's robes and into his skin.
"You old fool," he said, "where is your plot now, eh? Can you feel my bodkin? Does it tickle you? As that? Or that? I can drive it into your heart as quickly or slowly as I please. The wasps may be outside, but I've got the queen wasp here, "'And now what'll you do?'
"'I have never, to speak of things merely mortal, "'seen anything more wonderful than the priest's stillness. "'Hardly any man can be quite still "'when a finger, much less a dagger, "'is thrust into the place between two ribs. "'The priest was. "'Even his hands did not tighten on the arms of the chair.' Never moving his head or changing his voice, he said, "'Drive it in, King, swift or slow, if it pleases you. It will make no difference. Be sure the great offering will be made, whether I am dead or living. I am here in the strength of Ungit. While I have breath, I am Ungit's voice, perhaps longer. A priest does not wholly die.' I may visit your palace more often, both by day and night, if you kill me. The others will not see me. I think you will. This was the worst yet. The fox had taught me to think, at any rate to speak, of the priest as of a mere schemer and a politic man, who put into the mouth of Ungit whatever might most increase his own power and lands, or most harm his enemies. I saw it was not so. He was sure of Ungit. Looking at him as he sat with the dagger pricking him and his blind eyes unwinking, fixed on the king, and his face like an eagle's face, I was sure, too. Our real enemy was not a mortal. The room was full of spirits and the horror of holiness. With a beastly noise, all groan and snarl, my father turned away from the priest and flung himself into his own chair— and leaned back and passed his hands over his face and ruffled his hair like a man who is tired.
"'Go on. Finish it,' he said.
"'And then,' said the priest, "'we asked whether it was the king who was the accursed, and the lot said no.'
"'What?' said the king.
"'And this is the greatest shame I have to tell of in my whole life. His face cleared.' He was only a hair's breadth from smiling. I had thought that he had seen the arrow pointed at Psyche all along, had been afraid for her, fighting for her. He had not thought of her at all, nor of any of us. Yet I am credibly told that he was a brave enough man in a fight.
"'Go on,' he said.
But his voice was changed, freshened, as if 10 years of his age had slipped off him.
"'The lot fell on your youngest daughter, King. She is the accursed. The Princess Istra must be the great offering.'
"'It's very hard,' said the king, gravely and glum enough, but I saw he was acting. He was hiding the greatness of his own relief. I went mad. In a moment I was at his feet, clinging to his knees as suppliants cling, babbling out I didn't know what, weeping, begging, calling him father, a name I never used before. I believe he was glad of the diversion. He tried to kick me away, and when I still clung to his feet, rolling over and over, bruised in face and breast, he rose, gathered me up by my shoulders, and flung me from him with all his power. "'You!' he shouted. You to raise your voice among the councils of men, you trull, you queen, you mandrake root. Have I not woes and miseries and horrors enough heaped upon me by the gods? But you also must come scrabbling and clawing me. And it would have come to biting in a trice if I'd let you. There's vixen in your face this minute. For 2 straws I'd have you to the guardhouse to be flogged. Name of Ungit, are gods and priests and lions and shadow brutes and traitors and cowards not enough unless I'm plagued with girls as well? I think he felt better the longer he railed. The breath had been knocked out of me so that I could neither sob nor rise nor speak. Somewhere above my head I heard them talking on, making all the plans for Psyche's death. She was to be kept prisoner in her chamber, or no, better in the room with 5 sides, which was more secure. The temple guards would reinforce our own. The whole house must be guarded, for the people were weathercocks. There might be a change of mood, even a rescue. They were talking soberly and prudently, like men providing for a journey or a feast. Then I lost myself in darkness and a roaring noise. Chapter 6
"'She's coming to her mind again,' said my father's voice. "'Take that side of her, fox, and we'll get her to the chair.'
The 2 of them were lifting me. My father's hands were gentler than I expected.
I've found since that a soldier's hands often are. The three of us were alone.
"Here, lass, this'll do you good," he said when they'd put me in the chair, holding a cup of wine to my lips. "Fach! You're spilling it like a baby. Take it easy. So, what's better? If there's a bit of raw meat still to be had in this dog-hole of a palace, you must lay it on your bruises. Now look, daughter, you shouldn't have crossed me like that. A man can't have women, and his own daughter's what's worse, meddling in business."
There was a sort of shame about him, whether for beating me or for giving up Psyche without a struggle, who knows. He seemed to me now a very vile, pitiable king. He set down the cup.
"The thing has to be done," he said. "Screaming and scrabbling won't help. Why, the fox here was just telling me it's done even in your darling Greek lands, which I begin to think I was a fool ever to let you hear of."
"Master," said the fox, "I have not finished telling you. It is very true that a Greek king sacrificed his own daughter. But afterwards his wife murdered him, and his son murdered his wife, and those below drove the son mad."
At this the king scratched his head and looked very blank. "That's just like the gods," he muttered, "drive you to do a thing and then punish you for doing it. The comfort is I've no wife or son, fox."
I had got my voice again now. "King," I said, "you can't mean to do it. Istra is your daughter. You can't do it. You've not even tried to save her. There must be some way. Surely between now and the day—"
"Listen to her," says the king. "You fool. It's tomorrow they offer her."
I was within an inch of fainting again. To hear this was as bad as to hear that she must be offered at all. As bad. It was worse. I felt that I'd had no sorrow till now. I felt that if she could be spared only for a month, why, a month was like eternity, we should all be happy.
"It's better so, dear," whispered the fox to me in Greek. "Better for her and for us." "What are you mumbling about, fox?" said the king. "You both look at me as if I was some sort of two-headed giant they frighten children with. But what did you have me do? What would you do yourself, fox, with all your cleverness, if you were in my place?" "I'd fight about the day first. I'd get a little time, somehow. I'd say the princess was at the wrong time of the month to be a bride. I'd say I'd been warned in a dream not to make the great offering till the new moon. I'd bribe men to swear that the priest had cheated over the lots. There's half a dozen men across the river who hold land from him and don't love their landlord. I'd make a party, anything to gain time. Give me 10 days, and I'd have a secret messenger to the King of Fars. I'd offer him all he wants, without war. Offer him anything, if he'd come in and save the princess. Offer him Gloam itself and my own crown." "What?" snarled the king. "Be a little less free with other men's wealth, you best."
"But, master, I'd lose not only my throne, but my life to save the princess, if I were a king and a father. Let us fight. Arm the slaves and promise them their freedom if they play the man. We can make a stand, we of your household, even now. At the worst, we should all die innocent. Better than going down yonder with a daughter's blood on your hands." The king flung himself once more into his chair and began speaking with a desperate patience like a teacher to a very stupid child. I'd seen the fox do it with Redivall.
"I am a king. I have asked you for counsel. Those who counsel kings commonly tell them how to strengthen or save their kingship and their land. That is what counseling a king means. And your counsel is that I should throw my crown over the roof, sell my country to Fars, and get my throat cut? You'll tell me next that the best way to cure a man's headache is to cut off his head."
"I see, master," said the fox. "I ask your pardon. I had forgotten that your own safety was the thing we must work for at all costs." I, who knew the fox so well, could see such a look in his face that he could not have done the king much more dishonour if he had spat on him. Indeed, I had often seen him look at the king like that, and the king never knew. I was determined he should know something now. "King," said I, "the blood of the gods is in us. Can such a house as ours bear the shame? How will it sound if men say when you are dead that you took shelter behind a girl to save your own life?"
"You hear her, fox, you hear her," said the king, "and then she wonders that I black her eyes.
I'll not say mar her face, for that's impossible. Look, mistress, I'd be sorry to beat you twice in a day, but don't try me too far." He leaped up and began pacing the floor again. "Death and scabs," he said. "You'd make a man mad. Anyone would think it was your daughter they were giving to the brute. Sheltering behind a girl, you say? No one seems to remember whose girl she is. She's mine, fruit of my own body, my loss. It's I who have a right to rage and blubber if anyone has. What did I beget her for if I can't do what I think best with my own? What is it to you? There's some cursed cunning that I haven't yet smelled out behind all your sobbing and scolding. You're not asking me to believe that any woman, let alone such a fright as you, has much love for a pretty half-sister. It's not in nature. But I'll sift you yet." I don't know whether he really believed this or not, but it is possible he did. He could believe anything in his moods, and everyone in the palace knew more than he about the life of us girls. "Yes," he said more quietly now, "it's I who should be pitied. It's I who am asked to give up part of myself. But I'll do my duty. I'll not ruin the land to save my own girl. The pair of you have talked me into making too much work about it. It has happened before. I'm sorry for the girl, but the priest's right. Ungit must have her due. What's one girl? Why, what would one man be against the safety of us all? It's only sense that one should die for many. It happens in every battle." Wine and passion had brought my strength back. I rose from my chair and found that I could stand. "Father," said I, "you are right. It is fit that one should die for the people. Give me to the brute instead of Istra." The king, without a word, came up to me, took me, softly enough, by the wrist, and led me the whole length of the room to where his great mirror hung. You might wonder that he did not keep it in his bedchamber, but the truth is he was too proud of it for that, and wanted every stranger to see it. It had been made in some distant land, and no king in our parts had one to match it. Our common mirrors were false and dull. In this you could see your perfect image. As I had never been in the pillar room alone, I had never looked in it. He stood me before it, and we saw our two selves, side by side. "Ungit asked for the best in the land as her son's bride," he said, "and you'd give her that?" He held me there a full minute in silence. Perhaps he thought I would weep or turn my eyes away. At last he said, "Now be off. A man can't keep pace with your moods today. Get the beefsteak for your face. The fox and I must be busy." As I came out of the pillar room, I first noticed the pain in my side. I had twisted myself somehow in my fall. But I forgot it again when I saw how, in that little time, our house had changed. It seemed crowded. All the slaves, whether they had anything to do or not, were walking about and gathering in knots, wearing looks of importance, chattering under their breath, too, with a sort of mournful cheerfulness. They always will when there's great news in a house, and now it troubles me not at all. There were many of the temple guard lounging in the porch, some temple girls sitting in the hall. From the courtyard came the smell of incense, and sacrifice was going on. Ungit had taken the house. The reek of holiness was everywhere. At the foot of the staircase, who should meet me but Redival, running to me all in tears and a great babble pouring out of her mouth. "Oh, sister, sister, how dreadful! Oh, poor Psyche!" "It's only Psyche, isn't it? They're not going to do it to all of us, are they? I never thought it. I didn't mean any harm. It wasn't I, and oh, oh, oh!" I put my face close up to hers and said very low but distinctly, "Redival, if there is one single hour when I am Queen of Gloam, or even mistress of this house, I'll hang you by the thumbs at a slow fire till you die."
"Oh, cruel, cruel!" sobbed Redival. "How can you say such things, when I'm so miserable already? Sister, don't be angry. Comfort me."
I pushed her away from me and passed on. I had known Redival's tears ever since I could remember. They were not wholly feigned, nor much dearer than ditch water. I know now, as I felt sure then, that she had carried tattle about Psyche to the house of Ungit, and that with malice. It's likely enough she meant less mischief than she had done. She never knew how much she meant.
and was now in her fashion sorry. But a new brooch, much more a new lover, would have had her drying her eyes and laughing in no time. As I came to the top of the stairs, for we have upper rooms and even galleries in the palace, it is not like a Greek house, I was a little out of breath, and the pain in my side came on me worse. I seemed to be somewhat lame in one foot, too. I went on with all the haste I could to that five-sided room where they had shut Psyche up. The door was bolted on the outside. I have used that room for a courteous prison myself, and an armed man stood before it. It was Bardia.
"Bardia," I panted, "let me in. I must see the Princess Istra."
He looked at me kindly, but shook his head. "It can't be done, lady," he said.
"But, Bardia, you can lock us both in. There's no way out but the door."
"That's how all escapes begin, lady. I'm sorry for you and for the other princess, but it can't be done. I'm under the sternest orders."
"Bardia," I said with tears, my left hand to my side, for the pain was bad now, "it's her last night alive."
He looked away from me and said again, "I'm sorry."
I turned from him without another word. Though his was the kindest face, always excepting the fox, I had seen that day, for the moment I hated him more than my father or the priest or even Redival. What I did next shows how near I was to madness. I went as fast as I could to the bedchamber. I knew the king had arms there. I took a plain good sword, drew it, looked at it, and weighed it in my hand. It was not at all too heavy for me. I felt the edges and the point. They were what I then thought sharp. They were smart, soldier would not have called them so. Quickly I was back at Psyche's door. Even in my woman's rage I had man enough about me to cry out, "Ward yourself, Bardia!" before I fell on him. It was, of course, the craziest attempt for a girl who had never had a weapon in her hand before. Even if I had known my work, the lame foot and the pain in my side, to breathe deep was agony, disabled me. Yet I made him use some of his skill, chiefly, of course, because he was not fighting to hurt me. In a moment he had twisted my sword out of my grip. I stood before him with my hand pressed harder than ever to my side, all in a muck sweat and a tremble. His brow was dry and his breathing unchanged. It had been as easy as that for him. The knowledge that I was so helpless came over me like a new woe, or gathered the other woe up into itself. I burst into utterly childish weeping, like Redival.
"It's a thousand pities, lady, that you weren't a man," said Bardia. "You have a man's reach and a quick eye. There are none of the recruits would do as well at a first attempt. I'd like to have the training of you. It's a thousand—"
"Oh, Bardia, Bardia!" I sobbed. "If only you'd killed me, I'd be out of my misery now."
"No, you wouldn't," said he. "You'd be dying, not dead. It's only in tales that a man dies the moment the steel's gone in and come out. Unless, of course, you swap off his head."
I could talk no more at all now. The whole world seemed to me to be in my weeping.
"Curse it," said Bardia. "I can't bear this."
There were tears in his own eyes now. He was a very tender man.
"I wouldn't mind so much if the one weren't so brave and the other so beautiful. Here, lady, stop it. I'll risk my life and Ongit's wrath too."
I gazed at him, but was still not able to speak.
"I'd give my own life for the girl in there, if it would do any good. You may have wondered why I, the captain of the guard, am standing here like a common sentry. I wouldn't let anyone else do it. I thought if the poor girl called, or if I had to go in to her for any reason, I'd be homelier for her than a stranger. She sat on my knees when she was little. I wonder, do the gods know what it feels like to be a man?"
"You let me in?" I said.
"On one condition, lady. You must swear to come out when I knock. It's quiet up here now, but there'll be comings and goings later. There'll be two temple girls coming to her presently. I was warned of that. I'll give you as long as I can. But I must be sure of your coming out when I give the sign. Three knocks, like this."
"I'll come out at once when you do that."
"Swear it, lady, here on my sword."
I swore it. He looked to left and right, did back the bolt, and said,
"Quick, in you go. Heaven comfort you both."
Chapter 7 The window in that room is so small and high up that men need lights there at noon. That is why it can serve as a prison. It was built as the second story of a tower which my great-grandfather began and never finished. Psyche sat upon the bed with a lamp burning beside her. Of course I was at once in her arms and saw this only in a flash, but the picture, Psyche, a bed and a lamp, is everlasting. Long before I could speak, she said, "Sister, what have they done to you? Your face, your eye. He has been beating you again." Then I realized somewhat slowly that all this time she had been petting and comforting me as if it were I who was the child and the victim, and this, even in the midst of the great anguish, made its own little eddy of pain. It was so unlike the sort of love that used to be between us in our happy times. She was so quick and tender that she knew at once what I was thinking, and at once she called me Maya, the old baby's name that the fox had taught her. It was one of the first words she ever learned to say. "Maya, Maya, tell me, what has he done to you?" "Oh, Psyche," said I, "what does it matter? If only he had killed me, if only they would take me instead of you." But she would not be put off. She forced the whole tale out of me. How could one deny her, wasting on it the little time we had? "Sister, no more," I said at last. "What is it to me? What is he to either of us? I'll not shame your mother or mine to say he's not our father. If so, the name father is a curse. I'll believe now that he would hide behind a woman in a battle." And then, it was a kind of terror to me, she smiled. She'd wept very little, and mostly, I think, for love and pity of me. Now she sat tall and queenly and still. There was no sign about her of coming death, except that her hands were very cold. "Orwell," she said, "you make me think I've learned the fox's lessons better than you. Have you forgotten what we are to say to ourselves every morning? Today I shall meet cruel men, cowards and liars, the envious and the drunken. They will be like that because they do not know what is good from what is bad. This is an evil which has fallen upon them, not upon me. They are to be pitied, not—" She was speaking with a loving mimicry of the fox's voice. She could do this as well as butter did it badly. "Oh, child, how can—" But I was choked again. All she was saying seemed to me so light, so far away from our sorrow. I felt we ought not to be talking that way, not now. What I thought it would be better to talk of, I did not know. "Maya," said Psyche, "you must make me a promise. You'll not do anything outrageous. You'll not kill yourself. You mustn't, for the fox's sake. We have been three loving friends." Why must she say bare friends? "Now it's only he and you. You must hold together and stand the closer. No, Maya, you must. Like soldiers in a hard battle." "Oh, your heart is of iron," I said. "As for the king, give him my duty, or whatever is proper. Bardia is a prudent and courteous man. He'll tell you what dying girls ought to say to fathers. One would not seem rude or ignorant at the last. But I can send the king no other message. The man is a stranger to me. I know the henwife's baby better than him. And for Redival, send her your curse, and if the dead can—" "No, no, she also does what she doesn't know. Not even for you, Psyche, will I pity Redival, whatever the fox says. Would you like to be Redival? What? No? Then she's pitiable. If I'm allowed to give my jewels as I please, you must keep all the things that you and I have really loved. Let her have all that's big and costly and doesn't matter. Even the fox take what you please." I could bear no more for a while, so I laid my head down in her lap and wept. If only she would so have laid her head in mine. "Look up, Maya," she said presently. "You'll break my heart, and I to be a bride." She could bear to say that. I could not bear to hear it. "Orwell," she said very softly, "we are the blood of the gods. We must not shame our lineage. Maya, it was you who taught me not to cry when I fell." "I believe you're not afraid at all," said I. almost, though I had not meant it to sound so, as if I were rebuking her for it. "Only of one thing," she said. "There is a cold doubt, a horrid shadow in some corner of my soul. Supposing, how if there were no God of the Mountain, and even no holy shadow brute, and those who are tied to the tree only die day by day from thirst and hunger and wind and sun, or are eaten piecemeal by the crows and catamountains. And it is this... Oh, Maya! Maya!" And now she did weep, and now she was a child again. What could I do but fondle and weep with her? But this is a great shame to write. There was now for me a kind of sweetness in our misery for the first time. This was what I had come to her in her prison to do. She recovered before I did. She raised her head queen-like again and said, "But I'll not believe it. The priest has been with me. I never knew him before. He is not what the fox thinks. Do you know, sister, I have come to feel more and more that the fox hasn't the whole truth. Oh, he has much of it. It'd be dark as a dungeon within me but for his teaching. And yet, I can't say it properly. He calls the whole world a city. But what's a city built on? There's earth beneath. And outside the wall? Doesn't all the food come from there as well as all the dangers? Things growing and rotting, strengthening and poisoning. Things shining wet. In one way, I don't know which way, more like, yes, even more like the house of... Yes, of Ungit," said I. "Doesn't the whole land smell of her? Do you and I need to flatter gods any more? They're tearing us apart. Oh, how shall I bear it? And what worse can they do? Of course the fox is wrong. He knows nothing about her. He thought too well of the world. He thought there were no gods, or else, the fool, that they were better than men. It never entered his mind. He was too good to believe that the gods are real and viler than the vilest men. Or else," said Psyche, "they are real gods, but don't really do these things. Or even, mightn't it be, they do these things, and the things are not what they seem to be? How if I am indeed to wed a god?" She made me, in a way, angry. I would have died for her. This, at least, I know is true. And yet the night before her death I could feel anger. She spoke so steadily and thoughtfully, as if we had been disputing with the fox up behind the pear trees, with hours and days still before us. The parting between her and me seemed to cost her so little. "Oh, Psyche!" I said, almost in a shriek. "What can these things be except the cowardly murder they seem? To take you, you, whom they have worshipped and who never hurt so much as a toad, to make you food for a monster!" "You will say," I've said it many thousand times to myself, that if I saw in her any readiness to dwell on the better part of the priest's talk, and to think she would be a god's bride more than a brute's prey, I ought to have fallen in with her and encouraged it. Had I not come to her to give comfort if I could, surely not to take it away? But I could not rule myself. Perhaps it was a sort of pride in me, a little like her own, not to blind our eyes, not to hide terrible things, or a bitter impulse in anguish itself to say and to keep on saying the worst. "I see," said Psyche in a low voice. "You think it devours the offering. I mostly think so myself. Anyway, it means death. Or a while you didn't think I was such a child as not to know that. How can I be the ransom for all Gloam unless I die? And if I am to go to the god, of course it must be through death. That way even what is strangest in the holy sayings might be true. To be eaten and to be married to the god might not be so different. We don't understand. There must be so much that neither the priest nor the fox knows." This time I bit my lip and said nothing. Unspeakable foulness seethed in my mind. Did she think the brute's lust better than its hunger, to be mated with a worm or a giant eft or a spectre? "And as for death," she said, "why, Bardia there, I love Bardia. We look on it six times a day and whistle a tune as he goes to find it. "'We have made little use of the fox's teaching if we're to be scared by death. "'And you know, sister, he has sometimes let out that there were other Greek masters than those he follows himself. "'Masters who have taught that death opens a door out of a little dark room, "'that's all the life we have known before it, "'into a great real place where the true sun shines and we shall meet. "'Oh, cruel, cruel!' I wailed. "'Is it nothing to you that you leave me here alone? "'Psyche!' "'Did you ever love me at all?' "'Love you? "'Why, Maya, what have I ever had to love, "'save you and our grandfather the fox? "'But I did not want her to bring even the fox in now. "'But, sister, you will follow me soon. "'You don't think any mortal life seems a long thing to me tonight. "'And how would it be better if I'd lived? "'I suppose I should have been given to some king in the end, "'perhaps such another as our father.' And there you can see again how little difference there is between dying and being married. To leave your home, to lose you, Maya, and the fox, to lose one's maidenhead, to bear a child, they are all deaths. Indeed, indeed, Orwell, I'm not sure that this which I go to is not the best. This? Yes. What had I to look for if I lived? Is the world, this palace, this father, so much to lose? We have already had what would have been the best of our time. I must tell you something, Orwell, which I never told to anyone, not even you. I know now that this must be so even between the lovingest hearts, but her saying it that night was like stabbing me. "'What is it?' said I, looking down at her lap where our four hands were joined. "'This,' she said, "'I have always, at least... "'ever since I can remember, had a kind of longing for death. "'Oh, Psyche,' I said, "'have I made you so little happy as that?' "'No, no, no,' she said, "'you don't understand. "'Not that kind of longing. "'It was when I was happiest that I longed most. "'It was on happy days, when we were up there on the hills, "'the three of us, with the wind and the sunshine, "'where you couldn't see Gloam or the palace. "'Do you remember the colour and the smell?' "'and looking across at the grey mountain in the distance. "'And because it was so beautiful, it set me longing, always longing. "'Somewhere else there must be more of it. "'Everything seemed to be saying, "'Psyche, come!' "'But I couldn't, not yet, come, "'and I didn't know where I was to come to. "'It almost hurt me. "'I felt like a bird in a cage "'when the other birds of its kind are flying home.' "'She kissed both my hands.' "'flung them free and stood up. "'She had her father's trick of walking to and fro "'when she talked of something that moved her. "'And from now till the end, I felt, and this horribly, "'that I was losing her already, "'that the sacrifice tomorrow would only finish "'something that had already begun. "'She was—how long had she been, and I not to know— "'out of my reach, in some place of her own.' Since I write this book against the gods, it is just that I should put into it whatever can be said against myself. So let me set this down. As she spoke, I felt, amid all my love, a bitterness. Though the thing she was saying gave her, that was plain enough, courage and comfort, I grudged her that courage and comfort. It was as if someone or something else had come in between us. If this grudging is the sin for which the gods hate me— "'It is one I have committed.' "'Orwell,' she said, her eyes shining, "'I am going, you see, to the mountain. "'You remember how we used to look and long, "'and all the stories of my gold and amber house "'up there against the sky where we thought we should never really go? "'The greatest king of all was going to build it for me. "'If only you could believe it, sister. "'No, listen. "'Do not let grief shut up your ears and harden your heart.' "'Is it my heart that is hardened? "'Never to me, nor mine to you at all. "'But listen, are these things so evil as they seemed? "'The gods will have mortal blood, but they say whose. "'If they had chosen any other in the land, "'that would have been only terror and cruel misery. "'But they chose me. "'And I am the one who has been made ready for it "'ever since I was a little child in your arms, Maya.' The sweetest thing in all my life has been the longing to reach the mountain, to find the place where all the beauty came from.
"'And that was the sweetest. "'Oh, cruel, cruel. "'Your heart is not of iron. "'Stone, rather,' I sobbed. "'I don't think she even heard me. "'My country, the place where I ought to have been born, "'do you think it all meant nothing, all the longing for home? "'For indeed it now feels not like going, but like going back. "'All my life the god of the mountain has been wooing me. "'Oh, look up once at least before the end and wish me joy. "'I am going to my lover. Do you not see now?'
"'I only see that you have never loved me,' said I. "'It may well be you're going to the gods. "'You're becoming cruel like them.'
"'Oh, Maya!' cried Psyche, "'tears at last coming into her eyes again. "'Maya, I—'
"'Bardia knocked on the door. "'No time for better words. "'No time to unsay anything. "'Bardia knocked again and louder.
"'My oath on his sword, itself like a sword, was upon us. "'So—' The last spoiled embrace.
Those are happy who have no such in their memory. For those who have, would they endure that I should write of it?
Chapter 8 As soon as I was out in the gallery, my pains, which I had not perceived while I was with Psyche, came strongly back upon me. My grief even was deadened for a while, though my wits became very sharp and clear. I was determined to go with Psyche to the mountain and the holy tree, unless they bound me with chains. I even thought I might hide up there and set her free when the priest and the king and all the rest had turned to come home. Or if there is a real shadow brute, I thought, and I cannot save her from it, I'll kill her with my own hand before I leave her to its clutches. To do all this I knew I must eat and drink and rest. It was now nearly twilight, and I was still fasting. But first of all I must find out when their murder, their offering, was to be. So I limped along the gallery, holding my side, and found an old slave, the king's butler, who was able to tell me all. The procession, he said, was to leave the palace an hour before sunrise. Then I went to my own chamber and told my women to bring me food. I sat down to wait till it came. A great dullness and heaviness crept over me. I thought and felt nothing except that I was very cold. When the food came I could not eat. Though I tried to force myself to it, it was like putting cloth in my mouth. But I drank a little of the small beer, which was all they had to give me, and then, for my stomach rose against the beer, a great deal of water. I must have been almost sleeping before I finished, for I remember that I knew I was in some great sorrow, but I could not recall what it was. They lifted me into the bed. I shrank and cried out a little at their touch, and I fell at once into a dead stupidity of sleep, so that it seemed only a heartbeat later that they were waking me, 2 hours before sunrise, as I had bidden them. I woke screaming, for all my sore places had stiffened while I slept, and it was like hot pincers when I tried to move. One eye had closed up so that I might as well have been blind on that side. When they found how much they hurt me in raising me from the bed, they begged me to lie still. Some said it was useless for me to rise, for the king had said that neither of the princesses should go to the offering. One asked if she should bring butter to me. I told that one with bitter words to hold her tongue, and if I'd had the strength I would have hit her, which would have been ill done, for she was a good girl. I've always been fortunate with my women, since first I had them to myself and out of the reach of butter's meddling. They dressed me somehow and tried to make me eat. One even had a little wine for me, stolen, I guess, from a flagon intended for the king. They were all weeping. I was not. Dressing me, so sore I was, had taken a great time, so that I had hardly swallowed the wine before we heard the music beginning, temple music, ongit's music, the drums and the horns and rattles and castanets, all holy, deadly, dark, detestable, maddening noises. "Quick," said I, "it's time, they're going. Oh, I can't get up. Help me, girls. No quicker, drag me if need be. Take no heed of my groaning and screaming." They got me with great torture as far as the head of the staircase. I could now see down into the great hall between the pillar room and the bedchamber,
It was ablaze with torches and very crowded. There were many guards. There were some girls of noble blood, veiled and chapleted like a bride's party. My father was there in very splendid robes, and there was a great bird-headed man. By the smell and the smoke, there seemed to have been much killing already at the altar in the courtyard.